ज्ञानोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचिन्तानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमेन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning. Shivoham, Shivoham. I am consciousness and bliss, and so are you. So welcome to our final class in this series on the Yoga Vasishta, the great cut to the chase practice of Vedanta. And it's, as always, a divine pleasure to be with all of you. Just a moment of review before we continue. We began by looking at how the source of the mind, the place from which mind arises, is pure consciousness, and that the mind itself is made of pure consciousness, and that this consciousness holds all of reality within itself. And finally, that what we experience as a world is actually a series of thoughts arising and subsiding within one great mind, which is actually qualitatively not different from our own mind, hard as that can be to believe at certain levels of consciousness and it's in certain states. Of course, this is the non-dual understanding. It's in all the traditions. It's in all the non-dual traditions, that is, including Tantric Shaivism, Buddhism. You know, its corollary, which Vedanta loves to celebrate, this is one of the metaphors that the Vedantic sages adore, I guess, because even though they were sannyasins, they liked jewelry. So they would say, just as your gold bangles and your wedding ring are both made of gold, even though they look totally different, in the same way, your thoughts, your bodies, and the physical environment of the planet are all made of consciousness. I first heard this years and years ago from my first teacher, as I probably all of you have. And I remember trying to find that consciousness, which is supposedly within everything. And I would look at a tree and I would say, okay, let me see consciousness in that tree. And I never could. So it just went on looking like a hard, you know, tree trunk bark, tree trunk with leaves. And I eventually came to realize that because this world is all taking place through the mind, we actually have to transform the mind in order to see the reality. In other words, it always starts from in here. And that's what this text is really about. It's about cooking the mind, reprogramming the mind. I would say, go so far as to say, brainwashing us so that we can start to become subtle enough to perceive what is truly subtle. And last week, of course, we looked at the four essentials of this practice, of our part of this practice, which Vasishtha calls the four gatekeepers of the kingdom of liberation, which are sama, or tranquility, santosha, acceptance of what is, vichara, which is, of course, the fundamental practice, inquiry into the nature of reality, and sadhu sangha, sadhu satsang, which is the company of truth, and that truth takes the form of teachers, takes the form of texts, and it also takes the form of the group of spiritual friends, which is what we are. So we're having satsang with Vasishtha on one hand, and, you know, in all the traditions, it's said that there are certain sages, certain enlightened beings who remain within, let's say, hailing distance. In other words, they don't merge into the cosmos. They retain forms, and they do the work of keeping the world going despite all the crazy stuff that has been going on in this physical universe and between human beings for so many millennia. It's sages like Vasishtha, supposedly, who keep this whole thing going, and who also, of course, hold the promise that we can see the world as they see the world and experience the beauty of the world as they experience it. So when we invoke him, we're invoking the gurus, we're invoking the radically enlightened teachers, we're invoking the transmission, and we're invoking the power of satsang, the power of sangha, which includes not only each of us, but all the invisible beings who, like Vasishtha, are upholding the world or serving as guides to us, or simply hovering around trying to transmit a little bit of enlightenment to us, despite all our attempts to resist it. So the Sangha is everybody and anybody who's ever studied, realized, longed for, experienced, been influenced by the truth. And that's why we have momentum on the spiritual path, and why I sometimes suspect, as you may as well, that in this incredibly difficult, fraught time, somehow all these beings who hold this wisdom are kind of coming together and hovering around us, trying to make sure that enough of us get it so that we can take our civilization to a higher stage of consciousness rather than continuing to devolve. So we're going to continue by invoking those beings, by tuning into their power and their intention. And we'll be chanting in a few minutes, but let's first find a posture that's fully upright and relaxed at the same time. And begin to pay attention to the contact between your sits bones and your seat, to the feeling of your clothes against your skin. Inhaling with the feeling that the breath is going down towards the belly, exhaling with the feeling that it's rising, bringing your torso up through the crown. The back naturally flattens just a little bit as the chin moves downward and your shoulder blades release onto the back. Your eyes are closed. Your face is soft. As you allow your attention to center on the breath, which is the place we go when we want to start bringing ourselves from external awareness to internal awareness, we always seem to start with the breath. And as you are present with the breath, see if you can also be present with the full acceptance of your experience in this moment, which might include all sorts of sensations, some of them pleasant, some of them maybe not so pleasant, all the feelings, the thoughts. Notice your prana, how your prana is moving. How the energy is flowing in your body. And imagine that you're sitting in a circle with all of us. You're in a grove at the feet of the Himalayan mountains. It's dusk, and we're seated in our circle around a blazing sacred fire. This is the fire that carries our intentions to the subtle world, and through which the subtle realms shower their blessings on us, shower their wisdom and love on us. It's flowing, our intentions are flowing into the fire. The intentions of the guiding beings, the realized beings, are flowing into us through the fire. And recognize that in our connection to each other is the full presence of the divine. Ultimate reality, pure awareness, is, as Vashista says, as I've been quoting throughout this class, in the space between each of us. Consciously and fully inhabiting our bodies, begin to be aware of the breath flowing in and out of the nostrils once again, and see if you can go a little deeper into the body. See if you can become aware of the heartbeat. See if you can feel that pulsation that's sending blood through your body, creating a magnetic field that allows you to take in information at a very deep pre-verbal level, knowing that as you tune into your heartbeat, you're tuned to the fundamental life pulse, which is breathing you, which is flowing as your cranial sacral fluid, which is connecting you to the creative energy, the spunda, that upholds life. Feel the sensations of your muscles holding your body upright, buttocks and thighs slightly toned, the muscles in your back slightly toned, the sensations in your shoulders and neck, which hopefully you can take a moment to consciously relax. And the breath, of course. And become aware of thoughts, of sounds, letting your attention circulate between the awareness of sensation, the awareness of breath, the awareness of thought. And see if you can become aware of the awareness that makes it possible for you to experience all this consciousness that threads through your life experience. And we'll dedicate our practice, and then we'll chant the opening verses of the Yoga Vashista. By the power of our practice, we ask that all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. May all beings be free of craving, hatred, and dullness. May we know the unity of all that is. We offer this practice for the benefit of all beings and for the earth herself. And now the mantras, salutations to that beingness in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time, and into which they merge. Yata sarvani bhutani pratibhanti sthitani cha yatraivo pasamam yanti tasmai satyatmane namaha. Salutations to that aware consciousness, which is the source of the apparently distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge, and known, seer, sight, and seen, doer, doing, and deed. Yatanyanam tatanyeyam drashta darshana drishyabhu karta hetu kriya yasmat tasme nyaptyatmane namaha. And salutations to that which makes it all worthwhile, that bliss absolute, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness and unfoldment is derived from the shower of spray from the ocean of bliss. Sparanti sikarayasmad anandasyam vare vano sarvasham jivanam tasmai brahmananatma. Brahmandanatmane namaha. Spuranti, the spray from the ocean of bliss. And as the breath flows, and you keep a part of your attention on the flow of breath in and out of the nostrils, let's take it one step further into a practice that will be familiar to many of you. Imagine that your body is completely hollow, that your skin, like the membrane of a balloon, encloses pure space. And let that breath flow through that space. Flowing in, down, filling the spaces beneath your skin. The spaciousness of your inner body, your hollow body. Realizing that breath is flowing not only between your body and the so-called outside air, it's actually flowing through this entire universe, filling your hollow body with breath and energy. And from there, flowing out through the apparent body boundaries of the skin, just the way wind blows through a tree, connecting the physicality of the body with the subtle physicality of the air. Feeling the breath flow through the empty body, feeling your self-relaxing into the space within the body, which is hollow, which is empty, which is free. And as you sense the breath flowing like a subtle wind, flowing through your individual body, recognize that it's also flowing through all of us. and that just as the physical breath connects all parts of your body, in the same way, the subtle breath, the subtle prana, the shakti, is connecting all of us. One of the truths that Vedanta can make us realize is this paradox that we're connected the way the corners of a piece of paper are connected to a piece of paper. We're all connected. And yet we each of us have a completely unique perspective. So each of us is both a knower and what is known. So I'm the knower of my experience and also of you. I see your faces. I know your faces. And to you, I'm an object of experience and you're the knower. And flowing between us, making all of this connection possible, is the process of knowing, the ability that we have to know. And of course, our tendency to separate knowing, the knower, from what is known and from the process of knowing is the basic description of duality. And recognizing that the knower, the known, and the process of knowing are part of one single continuum of knowing, of awareness, of experience, is essentially enlightenment. And this is what Vasishtha tells us. He gives many definitions of enlightenment, but this is one of them, and it's very fundamental. When you realize that the knower, what is known, and the process of knowing are undifferentiated, then you're in the experience of enlightened awareness. And so Vedanta always wants to remind us that the knower is the observing consciousness and that the known is everything else, including your body, including your thoughts, including everything that comes up in your meditation, and of course, including what we experience as the physical world. And one of the things I was thinking about today as I was contemplating our class is that because all of it is consciousness and all of it will eventually lead us back to consciousness, you know, we can actually meditate on any one of these threefold aspects of consciousness. You know, so we can meditate on the knower, the awareness that we've been activating through this class and that many of you activate throughout your life. We can meditate on the known, which would be the breath, a mantra, the body, your emotions and ideas and thoughts. And we can meditate on the process of knowing, which is actually the capacity for cognition itself. The meditation on the knowingness, on the process of cognition, is actually a very subtle practice, because we normally take knowingness for granted, but it's a practice where you learn to feel into the part of the mind that is bringing up thoughts, the mechanism, so to speak, by which thoughts arise. And it is a mechanism. It's a, you know, it's a kind of an automatic process, which in Shaivism is called the Matrika Shakti, the power behind words, that makes thoughts arise, but which also makes perceptions arise. When you bring attention over and over again, for instance, as we were doing last week, where you think I am, and then you pay attention to the space at the end of I am, and you notice how in that space, there's stillness, and then thoughts will start to emerge. Movement will start to happen. And that cognitive processing, that quality of cognitive processing, which is essential to our experience of the mind, is the active intelligence or chit, the active consciousness, the active power of awareness that powers everything. So it's by meditating on the process of knowing that we begin to be able to experience what the sages call the true nature of mind as a single field of dynamic, intelligent energy, which has pure awareness at one end of the spectrum and active, unfettered thought formation at the other end. You know, so they're apparent opposites, still mind, emergent in awareness, active mind, emergent, immersion in thoughts and emotions and everything else. But they're actually all aspects of the same mind. This is what we can begin to experience. You can't really learn it from a book, though the teachings can point to it, but it has to be experienced. It has to become a direct experience. And as you know, it's worth digging for that experience because it is radically enlightening when you realize that your pure awareness and your crazed, thoughtful, agitated mind are actually part of the same continuum. Coming back to our shared consciousness, when two or more people are able to sit together, attend to the space that opens up between us, you know, then there's another form of what I would call enlightenment that we can experience, similar to knowing known and process of knowing practice, which is what I would call relational enlightenment. You know, that version of enlightenment is just as important as the more traditional classical process of getting to know the knower of your experience, because the way we learn to integrate the two simultaneous realities that we occupy, that is the reality of pure mind and unity and the reality of extraordinary diversity, the way we do this, the way we learn to hold unity and diversity together, Vasishtha says this is one of the definitions of enlightenment. One of the ways we learn to do this is through our relational awareness of other people. The scriptures are full of stories about sages who went to the forest and meditated for 12 years in absolute solitude, and then came down to the village and got jostled by somebody in the marketplace and went absolutely ballistic because they were not used to people. So we have to learn, and part of the process of our life is learning to find that relational connection that's beyond the words we use, it's beyond the bodies, but it's ever present. It's the awareness that the same consciousness is in you as in me. Vasishtha is very aware of this. And I would say it's one of the dualities, one of the paradoxes of spiritual practice. On the one hand, to really learn to isolate the awareness at the core of us, we need time in which we're not distracted by anything else, which can be the time we spend in meditation or can be the longer periods we might spend in retreat if we're able to do that. But even as we're turning our attention inside and doing our very best to recognize that which is beyond thoughts, at the same time, we have to recognize that we cannot avoid activity. Even when we're sitting in meditation, we can't avoid activity. Thoughts are happening, the breath is happening, distraction is happening. And the energies that play through our body mind, the Shakti herself, are always going to pull us into activity. And there's no point in trying to make ourselves inactive unless we happen to have fallen into a very deep samadhi, because basically inactivity is against nature. You know, as Krishna very famously says in the Bhagavad Gita, you cannot avoid action because the forces within you are going to drive you. And in the Shakta tradition, these forces are personalized. They're actually described as being little goddesses, little yoginis, each of which is in charge of a particular process. Some of them are in charge of hunger and thirst. Some of them are in charge of psychological states. Some of them are in charge of bringing our spiritual practice forward. And they're going to act whether we ask them to or not, because it's those forces, those energies And I do like to think of them as yoginis or goddesses. It just makes it cozy, but you don't have to. You just have to realize that there are these energies that are bringing the mind outward and that are essentially demanding that we engage in life, because that's what we're doing here. So do not mistake the teachings of Vedanta for an attempt to take us out of the world, except, you know, temporarily, because sometimes it's necessary. One of the most famous stories in the Yoga Vasishtha is a story that's meant to teach this point, and it's one that Vasishtha tells to Rama quite close to the end of the book. It's one of his final messages to Rama. It goes like this. There is a queen named Trudala who is married to a king named Shikidwaja, and they were utterly in love with each other. They ruled in harmony. They were equals in the kingdom, more or less, you know, had a wonderful court life, enjoyed the pleasures of sexuality, the pleasures of food, the pleasures of music, gave justice to their people. And at one point, as they engaged in their ongoing conversation, they started to ask these questions like, what is life really about? And why do I have this privilege? And, you know, who am I? What is there in this world that can make sure I never have to experience sorrow? And at that point, as we do, they start studying spiritual texts and they begin interrogating the local sages, who in those days were often very happy to be patronized by kings, eventually came to recognize that it's only knowledge of the self that can overcome suffering. So at this point, Trudala began to an obsessive program of self-inquiry, asking over and over again the question, who am I? Analyzing her experience according to the teachings. And she realized, she went through the process of neti neti, realizing, okay, my body is an object of my awareness. I can stand outside and look at it. Therefore, it can't be me. My thoughts are an object of awareness. Therefore, I am not my thoughts. She went through that whole process. And eventually, she had the direct experience of her true self as pure consciousness and saw that when the self becomes aware of an object, it covers itself with the mind and body, but always retains its nature as consciousness. So as she reflected in this way, she became more and more radically enlightened, meaning that she realized that everything that occurs is rising and falling in awareness. And yet she went on living her life, presiding over the court with her husband, taking care of her kids. And when her husband observed his wife in this state of absolute radiance, while yet being completely active in her life, he began asking her questions. He said, how have you attained this state of happiness? What are you doing? And she said, I've been doing self-inquiry and I've realized that I'm the ruler of the universe. I live in the delight of the self. I play with attraction and aversion as they arise. But whatever I see and think about, I see nothing but the one truth. That's what I've been doing. And Shikidwaja, despite his study, could not really get that his wife could be in that state. So he hugged her and he kissed her and he said, you are so cute. I love listening to you talk, but you know, I think you're confused. You know, you say, I don't see what's in front of me. I see consciousness. I think that's pure delusion. You're adorable, but you know, come on. So they left it at that. Things went on for a while. Trudala decided that she wanted to develop her psychic powers. So she, you know, she thought it would be cool to be able to change bodies, to fly in the sky, to visit different realms. And she started to do the practices for attaining yogic siddhis. Vasishtha explains what they are. He says she learned to stop the breath, fill up the channels in the body with prana so that her kundalini could rise to the central channel and get established in the crown. Vasishtha says, by the way, that if you can keep kundalini up here above the crown for 1 hour, you'll start talking to celestial beings. And that's what Trudala was doing. She learned how to make her body tiny. She learned how to dissolve the elements in her body so she could become invisible. All these practices are in the Yoga Sutras, but they don't tell you how to do them. Somehow, Sujala was a great yogini and she got it. And she kept trying to enlighten her husband, but he just could not take her seriously. I mean, she was his wife. But he kept it his own practice. He was very intentional about it. And he was more and more anxious for spiritual progress, but somehow it wasn't happening. And finally, he realized, he had a realization, let's call it a realization, that the only way it was going to work out for him is if he just gave up this whole kingship business and went into permanent retreat. So he went to Sujala and he said, I've realized that the only thing I care about is enlightenment. I've decided to leave the palace, go and live in the forest and do austerities until I attain it, like the Buddha. Sujala says, you know what? You're making a huge mistake. You're a king. You're a householder. You're 35 years old. It's not the time for you to retire from life. You're supposed to stay here and complete your dharma. And then when we're old, we can go to the forest. And the king said, what do you know? You know, first of all, you're a woman and everybody knows women can't be enlightened. And furthermore, you've been living in palaces your whole life. You know, obviously you're attached to your comfort zone. Here's what we'll do, he said. I trust you completely to rule the kingdom. So I'm going to turn it over to you. You are now the ruler of our country and I'm out of here. So that night he left the palace, collected a few things that an ascetic would need, like a water bowl and a stick for supporting himself in meditation and a deer skin. He went to a deep forest, walking the whole way, and built himself a rudimentary hut out of branches and leaves. Settled down, he would get water from the river. He would meditate 18 hours a day, keep himself awake through the night so he could continue to pray. And got really, really deeply serious. So months go by. And in the meantime, Sujala's worrying about her husband. So she uses her psychic powers to find out where he is. And she flies to the forest. She's able to see him. And she sees that even though he's making great efforts, he's really uncomfortable and unhappy. He has dysentery because the water is full of giardia. His body is covered with mosquito bites. He's itching all the time. He's, you know, extremely uncomfortable. And she's about to reveal herself to him and give him some good advice. But then she realizes that he's not going to be able to hear her. So she goes home and she goes back to her life and she rules the kingdom. And in this way, 18 years go by. And every couple of months, she'll fly out to where Shikadwaja is and she'll observe him and she'll go home. And then one day after all these years have gone by, she's out there and she sees that his despair and the intensity of his longing for the truth has reached a point where he might actually pay attention if somebody intervenes in the proper way. But she knew that he wouldn't listen to her if she showed up in her own form. So she created the form of a young sage named Kumbha and appeared in the forest in front of him. He was, of course, very surprised to see another human being there. He offered Kumbha tea. He bowed to him. He washed his feet. He asked Kumbha for his story. Kumbha told him a whole cock and bull story about how he was a grandson of the creator Brahma. And he was an enlightened sage who'd come to help Shikadwaja. And then he says, and what about you? And Shikadwaja says, well, I'm living in this forest, hoping to attain enlightenment, but it's not working. And Sujala, in her guise as Kumbha, says, you know what? You will only experience peace when you fully renounce everything. You just haven't renounced enough. And with that, she disappeared, which of course impressed her husband because not everybody can appear and disappear at will. But he was very confused. He said, well, I've already renounced my palace. I've given up my wife. I'm living in this funky hut. I'm drinking muddy water. I'm wearing bark. what more can I renounce? And then, well, okay, he said, I can renounce my hut. So he burned his hut. And then there he was, living under a tree. If you think the mosquitoes were bad before, they're now completely unbearable. His mind was very perturbed. A few weeks go by and Kumbha shows up again. So how are you doing? Kumbha asks. And the king says, well, actually, I'm not so great. I've given up my hut. You know, I'm living under this tree. I still don't have peace. And the sage says, you haven't renounced enough, and disappears. So it goes on like this. He renounces his clothes, his bark clothes. He renounces his water bowl so that in order to drink, he has to take river water in his hands. And he's starving, yet nothing is changing. So he finally decides that what he's actually supposed to do is give up his body. He builds a fire. He circumambulates the fire. He prays, and he's just about to jump into the fire when all of a sudden Kumbha appears in the grove, pulls him back, and says, what the hell do you think you're doing? The king says, well, obviously, I'm going to give up my body. It's the last thing I have to renounce. Kumbha says, and this is a powerful thing to contemplate. He says, what makes you think that your body is yours to renounce? Your body is the product of the sperm and ovum of your parents. It's made of the food you've eaten. What in this body is yours? You know, and he said, this whole time, you have not renounced anything that you have a right to renounce. Your palace is not yours. It's been handed down through your ancestors. Your clothes are not yours. Somebody else sewed them for you. Your wife is an independent person. So now you're about to renounce your body. The only thing you have that's yours to renounce is your ego, your feeling of identification with the personal self. Give that up. And that's all you have to do. So the king, who of course had heard this teaching a million times, was finally in a state of desperation, which was strong enough that he could actually pay attention to it. And as he heard those words, his identification with his body-mind dissolved, and he found himself in an absolute non-dual samadhi, completely merged in the bliss of consciousness. And he stayed in that state for days. And when he came out, Kumbha was still sitting in front of him. And the story goes on for a while, but eventually Shikidwaja and Kumbha become very good friends. And actually, Shikidwaja sort of falls in love with Kumbha. And at that moment, Chudala decides it's the time to reveal herself. So she sheds her body as Kumbha. And her husband, of course, is overwhelmed. He said, what are you doing here? And she explains to him what happened. So, and, you know, he's ecstatic. He embraces her. And then he says, okay, so now we're both enlightened. Here we are in the forest. Let's just stay here and we can be sadhus together. And she goes, nope, can't do that. This is not your dharma. So you have to come back with me to the kingdom, to the palace. We'll rule together and the fragrance of our enlightenment will spread to everyone in the kingdom. And that's what happened. And the story goes that they ruled for hundreds of years. This is a myth. And that their kingdom was so full of enlightened people that even the parrots in the trees would sing, Shivoham, I am Shiva, I am that. So that's the state that Vasishtha actually wants Rama to experience. And of course, that is actually what happened to Rama. Of course, he's speaking to the universal misunderstanding about what spiritual life entails. And I know that many of you, and I include myself in this, have a sort of underlying feeling, which we got from all the myths about what spiritual life is really about that have gathered for centuries, that either you're a worldly person or you're a sadhu renunciate, and that you cannot really make serious spiritual progress without giving up everything. But what Vasishtha wants us to do is to really contemplate the story of Chidala and to realize that outer renunciation is not only unnecessary over the long run, even though it's a good thing to do for a couple of hours a day or even half an hour as you sit in meditation. It's not only unnecessary, it also doesn't work, you know, because what we need to give up is our addiction to identifying with our thoughts, our bodies, and personalities. You know, combining meditation and vichara, we can gradually experience the deepest layers of self and learn to rest in it, and we'll be brought out of it by the demands of our life and the demands of our vasanas, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. But it's that whole process of going into, let's say, higher states of consciousness and then coming back to our normal bound, you know, physicalized, physically uncomfortable, emotionally labile self that we actually learn to integrate the depths of our connection to consciousness and our ordinary life. So it's actually one of the secrets of integration, and it's the way it's set up. You go back and forth, in and out, over and over and over again. As the buried samskaras and vasanas come up to be experienced and seen and let go of, you continually return to the breath and the process of awareness of awareness. Close your eyes. Bring your awareness to the contact of the breath with the nostrils. Feel yourself entering into the hollow body. Feeling your body as a hollow space surrounded by a thin membrane of skin. And as the breath blows through your hollow body, see if you can notice the sensations that arise with the breath without attaching them, without attaching names to them, without trying to understand what they are, just experiencing whatever arises. As you rest more and more deeply in the sense of spaciousness and the breath flowing like wind through your hollow body, turn your attention more and more into that space. And see if you can allow the back of your body to soften and open and allow your attention to flow through it. So that the space inside your body is connected to the space behind and around your body. In other words, see if you can allow the boundary to dissolve. Can you notice how thoughts and sensations arise like bubbles inside the spaciousness? how they seem to pop up out of nowhere. And are experienced and held within that space. Ask yourself, how big is this space? Does it have borders? How big is my awareness? And is this awareness inside this room? Or is this room and everything that I can imagine inside this space of awareness? Without getting lost in the dialogue, in the question, just see if you can recognize the knowingness, the awareing. And notice that it really has no limits. That as you explore it, you can't come to the end of it. And notice how something comes up. And as it were, shuts down that spaciousness. Hopefully for some of you, that's not happening, but for some of you, it is. And we're going to let it happen because we want to understand the process by which identification, which we call vasana, arises and literally contracts awareness. And again, for some of you, you may now be inside your body again. The experience of yourself as pure awareness can only happen in the present moment. You can't find it through memory. And one reason for that is that memory is a function of ego. Ego operates through memory, through connecting our present experience to our past experience, and then identifying it all as me. And as we all know, ego is always ready to take an awakening experience, an expansion experience, and use it to inflate itself, use it to identify oneself as an expanded consciousness. But in the moment we do that, we contract consciousness. It's one of the most frustrating things about human experience. So here we are. Our attention is in the hollow body with the breath. And once again, please turn your attention backward. Let your attention flow out the back body. And look into the suchness that we call psyche or consciousness or mind. In what are your thoughts arising? In what are sensations arising? Just be with the backdrop, the background, the intelligent container. The unbounded awareness. Within which a thought, a memory, a perception, your reaction to my voice, momentarily condenses the space of mind. And then when you let go of it, and I'll be quiet, allows awareness to let go of dwelling on thoughts and feelings and just dwell in itself. So if you've fallen out of connection to that spaciousness, come back to it. And I hope that you're noticing what it is that comes up, how it happens that some thought or idea or feeling will come up. And you'll identify with it, happens automatically. And then you let it go. You let yourself be that very alive, very subtle, very intelligent awareing, that knowing, that presencing, within which experience is appearing and dissolving. A thought comes up like, am I getting it right? Or where is it? Or, oh, this is so boring, or whatever. Oh my God, that's it. Whatever it is, notice how every time a vasana, a thought comes up, it contracts the space. And yet that knowingness, that awareness is right there. Let the thoughts arise. Notice the thoughts and let them dissolve. and allow yourself to get a deeper and deeper felt sense of that ground. That intelligent ground. It has the quality of dynamism, as well as the quality of stillness, and which is constantly throwing up thoughts just out of pure playful desire to create. And notice how once the process has started, the vasanas get more and more present, start to fill up the space. Whoops, let that go, be in the space. Some of you are really practiced at staying aware of awareness. Some of you less so. But pretty much all of us will probably notice that we can't stay in that awareness experience more than a couple of minutes because the vasanas are going to show up, fill up the space. And that's why we need practices other than simply vichara, because we also need to tame the vasanas, or at least to understand them. So I want to talk for a few minutes about the word vasana, which I know is not unfamiliar to many of you. Many of you here are very practiced and well-read in these traditional understandings of the human being. And you also know that they're generally speaking two words that describe the thoughts and feelings that fill us up. One of them is samskara, which rhymes with samskaras, and that's pretty much what it means. Samskaras are the grooves that every experience and every thought and every emotion creates in consciousness, kind of like when drops of water fall into a lake, they create a little pockmark or a little groove. And then the water fills them. The water comes back and fills the space. But if we keep going down the same pathways, the space becomes deeper and deeper, and the samskara turns into a vasana. Vasanas are the deep grooves, the deep tendencies that arise from repeatedly believing our samskaras and acting on them such that they become so embedded in your psyche that they become the lines of your character and they begin to run your life from underground, from the basement. And they're so deep that we normally aren't aware of them. Or let's say there are some of them that we're aware of, because a lot of you have done psychotherapeutic self-inquiry and looked at what your patterns are, your psychological patterns are. But what you can notice, and I want to ask you to do this as I speak, if you turn your attention directly into your citta, notice how your mind moves. You can begin to see how there are some channels. They're literally structures through which mind energy flows. And these are what we could call your default patterns. They're part of the default mode network, which neuroscientists are beginning to talk about. The repetitive thoughts and conclusions that make us who we are. These are what we experience as moods and as all the ways we recognize ourselves. You know, I'm that person who feels insulted when somebody disrespects me, or I'm that person who just adores my nephew. You know, I'm that person. I recognize who I am by noticing the thoughts and feelings that I'm used to. So what you'll eventually realize is that what all these channels are doing, what all these vasanas are doing, is one thing and one thing only. They're identifying with something. They're telling you, this is me. This thought is real. You know, whether it's a question, how am I doing? Am I okay? Is this situation good for me? So these basic channels of identifying with your habitual thinking patterns, as well as with your body and everything else to do with your personal embodiment, these are the vasanas, and they're the characteristic mind patterns that keep you stuck to your ordinary identity. And they're not just personal. In other words, they're not just the result of reenacting your childhood coping patterns whenever a similar situation gets triggered. The basic binding vasanas are shared. They're pretty much universal. They're the conceptual frames, like, this is what it is to be a human being, or this is what it is to be in reality. This time and this place is the present moment. It's the reality. Everything else, maybe it exists, maybe it doesn't, but I only know this. I only know what's real, what I think is real. And these are the universal linchpins of everybody's personal perceived identity. These are the linchpins of what we call the ego. And the one meaning of the word vasana is fragrance or smell. Every one of us has a characteristic smell, as any dog can tell you. And when you get close to somebody, you smell it. In some people, it's very pleasant, and some people, not so pleasant. Vasanas are the subtle version of this. They're the fragrance of our tendencies, which cannot be disguised any more than the smell of our bodies can be disguised. And especially if you've been eating onions or cutting onions or eating garlic, your fragrance, you know, can be, you can smell, people can smell your fragrance from across the room. And this is also true of the vasanas that create your character. Even though people can't necessarily identify them as, like, they can identify the smell of onions, we identify somebody who has a lot of angry vasanas, and we feel it, and it affects us. You know that. Our mental conditioning, our vasanas radiate from us. And actually, most of the spiritual work that we do in the course of a lifetime is about refining the vasanas. You know, and most of us in the wellness and self-improvement and growth, you know, human potential space, have spent hours in the course of our life, you know, refining our childhood conditioning, which means to say working with our vasanas. And that one result of that is that every one of you here, maybe there's some exceptions, but I doubt it, is considerably more enlightened than you were when you were 20. Even if you're only 25, you're nonetheless considerably more enlightened than you were 5 years ago. And because our way of, you know, our life is experienced through our vasanas, when our vasanas become refined, our experience of our life also becomes far more conscious and far more pleasurable. One of the things that I've been very fascinated by in reading the latest, or the, you know, not so latest, but the discoveries about DNA and epigenetics that have come through biological understanding in the last 20 years, you know, is this idea that just as the brain has plasticity, the DNA also has plasticity. So everything in our environment affects the DNA, and also a lot of the experiences of our ancestors affect the DNA. But what they've also discovered is that you can change the DNA by changing the way you think and feel about yourself. Your own thoughts and feelings, as the Shista says, though not in those words, of course, have the most profound effect on your ability to navigate your own DNA and literally change the internal circumstances and thus change the external circumstances as well. You know, Bruce Lipton has written a very interesting book about this, which many of you have read. It's not a new book, called The Biology of Belief. And this is all about vasana, about how vasana works. Vashista believes that vasana is the key to the incredible diversity of human experience. You know, he compares vasana to the coating on a mirror or the prescription of your glasses. You know, there are some glasses prescriptions that improve your vision, but if you get the wrong prescription, it's going to distort your vision. One of the things, though, that Vashista says, it's a major teaching in this text, is that no matter what your karma, no matter what destiny you brought into this life, you can change it through the effort that you make to transform your vasanas. Even though there are certain tendencies that will be with you for your whole lifetime, because they're part of the karmic pattern that you've come into this life with and that you're meant to deal with, nonetheless, you can free yourself from being ruled by them. You know, they'll come up, you can see them, you can recognize them, and you can begin to let them go. So close your eyes if you haven't closed them already, and feel the breath flowing in and out through the nostrils. Feel the coolness on the inhalation, the warmth in the exhalation. And just focus fully. On the breath. Because most of us have done quite a lot of breath practice over the years, we have a vasana that allows us to bring our attention to the breath and center on the breath, which is a good example of a spiritually productive vasana. And even given the differences between your breathing and my breathing, the basic experience of feeling the breath flowing in and out, feeling the mind come to rest in the breath, is a shared experience. It's a universal experience. And so is the vasana of anger. You know, one of the great practices of Buddhism is Tonglen, where you actually breathe in another person's pain and you breathe out their happiness. And when I first discovered Tonglen as a practice, the thing that really blew me away was that I could do this when I was, say, angry or when I was sad, you know, when I was scared. I could do Tonglen. I could breathe in my fear, breathe out my, and breathe out peace. I could breathe in my anger and breathe out peace. And what I started to do was to imagine groups of people. I was working with anger at the time. Imagine groups of people who were angry. And if you start thinking like this, you can think of people all over the world who are angry and who even have what I would call a good reason for being angry. So I would let my mind dwell on these groups of people and breathe in their anger and breathe out peace to them. And little by little, as I did this, I began to realize that my anger and their anger were not different. There's not Sally's anger and, you know, the anger of somebody in a Ukrainian refugee camp. It's just anger. It's the anger, not my anger or your anger. In other words, there's a vasana of anger that is universal. And that's true of all the great thought forms. They're vortexes in the universe. Vashishta actually says that none of our habit patterns belong to us individually. They're energetic vortexes that we fall into when one of these vasana patterns arises in us. In shamanistic work, there's an idea that there are spirits in the universe who are attracted to us, who resonate with us. And, you know, for instance, if you tend to be depressed, then you will tend to attract depressed spirits who will sometimes fasten themselves to your energy body and need to be cleared. The point being that these particular energies are just running around the universe, and we tap into them and we fall into them. And part of what we can do that's really, really skillful in self-transformation work is to recognize those, to recognize, oh, I'm in the anger vortex. It's not, I may have a story about it. I may have all kinds of good reasons for being angry, but the anger itself is an energetic experience that comes out of the field. And if I can switch out of the anger vortex into, you know, like a more neutral vortex or even a more positive one, I can actually leave the anger behind, at least for the time being. You know, and it's, if you, you know, when you fall in love, even though you're an individual in love with another individual, you fall into the romantic love vortex. You know, it's the same, maybe stronger in some people, not so strong in others, but it's the same. It's a universal experience. When you have a shame attack, what Brené Brown calls a shame attack, you're falling into a universal experience. We all have it. It feels the same, even though, again, the more mature we are, the less taken out by it we are. But shame is shame. And it's not yours. It's not mine. Then the same is true of religious and spiritual energies. You know, if you walk into the room where people are doing devotional practices, they might be Christians, they might be Hindus, they might be doing Sufi dancing. The conversation may be in different languages, but the heart energy of a strong devotion, of a room full of strong devotional practitioners, is immediately recognizable, even if it's not your tradition. And, you know, in the same way, if you're tuned to what I call the Buddhist energy vortex, which is a particular type of awareness that if you've been in a lot of Buddhist gatherings, you recognize it. There's a vasana, set of vasanas that when they come together, they create the experience of the Buddhist spiritual vortex. So everything that we experience in our, the particularity of our life is the play of asanas. The trick is to recognize first that the vasanas are not really yours. And secondly, and this seems paradoxical, but that they're arising and subsiding inside that consciousness, which is both your personal consciousness and the universal consciousness shared by everyone. And with all the uniqueness of our histories and the way our minds work, we're all subject to the play of these vasanas. And because the vasanas are arising and subsiding inside the field of consciousness, inside the field of mind, when you're in a state of high reactivity and can manage to hold that feeling of that state in awareness, or do tonglen with it, or introduce it to a mantra, or breathe through it, what will start to happen is that the vasana will dissolve. And what that means is, even though it may not completely dissolve, but layers of it will be gone. And when we're talking about gradual sadhana, we're actually talking about the gradual process of allowing strong vasanas to dissolve in consciousness. Over time, as you work with the roots of your vasanas, you may recognize the moment in your early life, for instance, when that pattern was formed. And, you know, as many of you know, when you can do that, when you can turn back to that, just holding that in awareness is going to reframe it. It's going to resolve it. And then I want to stress this, and it's going to be part of your homework for those of you who are interested in trying this out. When you dissolve a vasana, even momentarily, the trick is not to try to come back to it. In other words, to let it stay dissolved. Because what we will tend to do is we'll go, oh my God, my feeling of abandonment. I recognize the moment when my mother didn't pick me up when I was in my crib. I've had this experience myself. I realized that it gave rise to this characteristic feeling that's been, I've been suffering from my whole life. Now I see it and it's gone. And so what that means is that I should find a therapist and figure it out and see if I can analyze that moment and come back to it again and again. Give myself the ability to, you know, to actually let go of it forever. But in fact, you don't have to do that, because once it's gone, it is actually gone. Again, there may be pieces of it that will come up again and again, but once you've managed to detach yourself from it, even once or twice, you've defanged it for yourself. That's the root of liberation in many ways. Otherwise, you know, if you remember that Yiddish story about the guy who was on a train and there was an old man sitting next to him, and the man, this is a Hasidic story, so he talks in a Yiddish accent. He said, "Oi, am I toasty? Oi, am I toasty? Oi, am I toasty?" And finally the other passenger gets up and goes to the back of the train car and brings a cup of water back to the man, and drinks it very, very thirstily. And puts it down and he goes, "Ah, oi, was I toasty? Oi, was I toasty?" So this is what we often do. "Oi, I was so unhappy. Oi, I was so unhappy." And when we do that, we lose the opportunity to just let it go, forget about it, and be free in that moment. Again, let's bring ourselves back to the breath. Looking through the thoughts and feelings that are present in your consciousness right now. turn your attention backward. Feel the breath rising and subsiding. Allow that sense that you're bounded by the skin barrier to loosen and dissolve. Recognizing that when you're in the woods at the border between the US and Canada, for example, there's a moment when you just walk over the border. You know, there's no border crossing, there's no guards deep in the woods. And you realize that border is just an imaginary line that has no bearing on reality. It's the same with the body boundary. It's a useful fiction. But the skin is made of consciousness. The bones are made of consciousness. And you can softly slip out from the cage of the body, experience the vast spaciousness that surrounds you. And then when you want to come back into the body, which is a comfortable dwelling place, knowing that like Chudala, you actually have the power to dissolve your sense of being stuck in a particular place and time and just open to the spaciousness. Just be present with the breath flowing through the hollow body, flowing through the space around you. And as you identify yourself, even for a moment, with what we can call space or emptiness or awareness, consider a situation that now or in the past you found frustrating. Bring it into awareness. Notice how when you do that, when you hold it for a little while, the feelings associated with it start to permeate your mind space. And then allow yourself to become aware of the awareness space that holds the frustration. And see if you can hold that vortex of frustration inside awareness and notice what happens. And without staying too much in that thought experiment, just be with the breath as it flows through the space within the body and the space behind the body. Ask yourself, where is awareness? And notice that which rises in answer to that question. Can you space out into awareness? Can you let yourself be that? Don't ask yourself, is this it? Just take for granted that awareness knows itself. That you, as awareness, know yourself. So vasana is the expression of diversity. What makes distinctions within the vast homogeneous consciousness is that everybody and everything has their own unique conditioning. At a macro level, Shakti contracts herself to become all this. At a micro level, we cement our identities through our conditioned experience, which we keep cementing deeper and deeper into ourselves until we learn how to let it dissolve. But even after enlightenment, everyone has their own vasana, which is why Ramana Maharshi was a completely different person than Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, even though they both had fully awake consciousness. Even though they were both enlightened. Consciousness, as long as you're in a body, is going to condense itself in order to give you the experience of individuation. It's always going to do that, and we need it to do that, otherwise we couldn't walk around here. But what Vashishta talks about is that there are two types of conditioning. The first type is what he calls sterile conditioning or binding conditioning, which is the conditioning that essentially creates suffering, part of which has to do with our specific personal karmic vasanas, but part of which is what we absorb from culture, and from the whole realm of collective experience. But then there's what Vashishtha calls it adorable conditioning, which I think is such an adorable way of describing it. And this is the conditioning of enlightened beings, beings who have reached the place where they can volunteer to be part of the game of life, because they've chosen over lifetimes to know themselves as awareness and then to direct their lives towards helping others. And Vashishtha also says that this is what deities are as well. You know, Vishnu and Shiva and the goddesses, and of course the great beings of history. They're actually expressions of consciousness that have chosen to accept certain limitations for the sake of protecting the world or awakening others. But even while being entangled in life and in karma, and they all are, you know, it's why great beings can get cancer and, you know, have accidents and generally experience what all people experience. But if you have adorable conditioning, you don't identify with that anymore, or at least not for more than a few minutes. And that's when our activities become what the Buddhists call bodhisattva activity. Activities that arise either because the shakti in our systems is making hunger and thirst and, you know, ideas, etc., arise. But also because so much of what these beings do is the movement of compassion inside consciousness. I know this is an experience that you've all had of how when you're inside your dharma, the impulses that arise are impulses to deep empathy or towards enlightening yourself or towards going out of your way to help another person. Because these are natural human feelings that simply get blocked by certain vasanas so that we can't fully experience them. The Yoga Vashishtha is an expression of Vashishtha's bodhisattva nature, of his enlightened activity. So what he's always pointing out here is that our aim in enlightenment practice and self-realization practice is not to dissolve into consciousness and never again return, although we may choose to do that. The goal is to become free in life by recognizing the nature of the mind and then being able to enjoy all this and to be of help. So do you have time for one more list before we close? So Vashishtha at the end of the book talks about the stages of enlightenment, what he calls the process of waking up, the map of waking up, the map of the stages. And, you know, many traditions talk about the stages of enlightenment. So these are the ones that come from Vashishtha and from the recognition of Vedanta. So the first one, the first stage starts, as with Rama, at the moment that you ask yourself, why am I suffering? And at that moment, you begin to realize the degree to which you're suffering is the result of the way you're seeing your experience. So there's a lot that happens in this space. Michael Beckwith talks about how we transition out of victim consciousness. And the first stage of enlightenment is the transition out of feeling like a victim of life. So you're no longer blaming it on your parents or the capitalist system or any of the other, you know, sucky things that go on in the world. You realize it's nobody's fault, but nonetheless, no matter what anybody else has done, we have the power to remove ourselves from the ideas that keep us mired in suffering. That's when we begin to try to work with the mind, to try to transform the mind. We ultimately realize that you cannot talk yourself out of suffering. Have you noticed that? You can't talk yourself out of it. You can't say to yourself, look at all the Ukrainians. You know, these are people who are really suffering. Here I am in my privileged life, in whatever situation I'm in, and bad things are happening, but they're not that bad. So you can't just talk yourself out of pain by telling yourself, shape up. This is the point in which we begin to experience what Vashista calls subicha, which means auspicious desire, the longing to know what's real, the longing for the love that doesn't go away, the longing for the truth. And this, which is the second stage of enlightenment, it starts to lead you towards deeper, deeper and deeper, towards being able to recognize the truth of what you are. Even a very mild desire for truth is going to be effective in this way. And at this point, as the momentum builds, you enter the stage called vicharana. And vicharana, which is of course related to vichara, is the state of always questioning reality. When you recognize that you don't have the power to will suffering away, you know, that you can't take a Zoloft or a gummy. I mean, you can, of course, but it's only going to be a temporary fix. And what happens then is that you begin to observe it. You know, you begin to directly observe sorrow. You let yourself be with it without resisting it and without wallowing in it, which is a trick. It takes practice or trying to run away from it. And as you do this, as you stop looking, if you stop going, help, make this go away. As you let yourself sit with it, the mind stops racing, stops looking for a solution, and begins to learn to just sit with reality. And again, as you do this, as you start to be able to sit with pleasure and pain, your mind becomes more and more transparent. Vashista calls this the state of tannumasi, which just means the transparent mind. Your desire to feel better begins to dissolve a little bit. Your self-centeredness begins to dissolve a little bit. Again, Vashista says it's like looking into a mirror when the silver has been taken off the back of it. So instead of seeing your own reflection, instead of seeing your suffering mirrored back to you over and over again in an endless feedback loop, it becomes transparent. You're able to see through the mind and see reality as it is. Thoughts arising, the squirrel running up the tree in front of your house, your wife's face. And ultimately you get to the point where you can see anger arising, you can see sadness arising, you can begin to sense. And as I say this, please don't think that I'm implying that there's no such thing as real, honest to God suffering. Of course there is. It's part of the experience. But you begin to recognize that you can watch the arising of it. And you can sense that it's the very attempt to make yourself happy that gives rise to suffering. You know, that Buddhists say pain is necessary, suffering is optional, and that it's not quite that simple. But you can begin to notice, and certainly this is true about mental suffering, that certain stories, certain experiences trigger characteristic vasas, and you can just observe them. Again, that doesn't mean you stop trying to change things or make things better. It's really about being able to see through the veils that make you always identify with what's pleasant for you or unpleasant for you. And eventually you get to the state which Vashista calls padartha abhavana, which is, bhavana means attitude or feeling. Abhavana means without attitude. Pada and artha. Pada means word and artha means the object that the word signifies. So padartha abhavana is the realization that you give meaning to your experience according to the way you describe it. So if you give a sensation the name of painful, you experience it painfully. If you give it the name pleasure, you experience it as pleasurable. And in this state of padartha abhavana, you recognize that the meaning of any situation is conferred by your own attitude. And I want to be very careful in saying this, because it's very easy to misunderstand this and, you know, tell people it's your own fault that you're suffering. And of course, it's really not that simple. But there's a certain point in your sadhana where this becomes a resource, where you can actually reframe the way you're seeing your experience, and it's going to change the way you experience it. So you're just there with your life, which sometimes feels good, sometimes doesn't feel so good. Right now I have an all over body itch. It's kind of like prickly heat, unbelievably irritating. And yet if I can just not identify it as something horrible that's happening to me, it has the most amazing effect. It becomes okay. It becomes bearable. I can live with it. And I wish it would go away, but I can live with it. And, you know, it's possible to experience sorrow and pain without thinking there's something wrong with you or something wrong with life. Taking pain as a signal. Understanding that if you don't get what you want, of course you deal with it, but you don't identify with the me who's disappointed. You don't make it all about how you're a failure. And you can stay present with the feeling of disappointment, examine it, but your deep well-being is based on your recognition that what you are is awareness and what you are is free. No matter what comes up, you're free. So this is what the Shista wants us to understand, is that we're free, we are awareness, we're infinitely creative. And your freedom, the freedom of your own consciousness, is also the freedom of bliss, because our existence ultimately is a shower of spray from the ocean of bliss, no matter how it feels in this moment. That's what it really is. So just as awareness is always present, whether you see it or not, love is always present, whether you see it or not, because your being is made of love. And in that self-recognition, you become that ecstatic awakened being that Vasishtha is pointing it towards. And you start to realize that ecstatic awakened being is right over here. If I can just switch my attention to being that, I'll experience myself very differently. If I'm letting my attention be in my victimhood or in my feeling of unfairness, or even in my righteous, justifiable anger about the way the world is, you can hold all that inside love, inside awareness. As we bring our 3-week immersion in the Yoga Vasishtha to a close for now, be present with the breath. Turn your attention backward. Letting your attention move, let's say, into the heart, the center in the chest. And let the breath draw your awareness into the heart. And see if you can allow the back body to soften and open. Feel your heart connected to the presence of love which surrounds each of us and all of us, which is breathing us, which is meditating on us, which is adoring us. And with your inner gaze turned in that direction, into the open space of love and awareness behind your heart, ask yourself, who am I really? And allow that presence to show you, you are this, your presence, your knowingness, your tenderness. Let yourself receive the gift of presence that is you. Meditate on that one who is always meditating on you, who is the vastness of consciousness, and who is also your consciousness. Let yourself be that. So may we continue to meet each other. And I know we will over the months, weeks and months to come. And of course, there's another week of practice. You'll be getting a homework assignment and the listserv will be open. And I know that many of you here are forming connections with each other through the listserv or through working with a partner. And that those connections are really satsang for so many of you. So may you have so many connections to satsang throughout your life. And may you be most profoundly well as you're held within the blessing of the sages. We're going to close by returning to the hymn of Shankaracharya's. I am not the mind of the prana. I am not sleep or hunger or thirst. I am not a student. I am not a teacher. I am consciousness. I am bliss. So let yourself dissolve into that beautiful awareness. Namaste. And thank you so much for being here, for participating, for bringing your Shakti to this gathering. And thank you always to Deb, who makes this possible. So much love to all of you. Mano buddhi ahankara chintani nahi na cha shrotra jihve na cha ghrana netre na cha vyoma bhumi na tejo na vayu Chidananda Rupa Shivoham Shivoham Chidananda Rupa Shivoham Shivoham Nacha Prana Sangyona Vai Pancha Vayu Nava Sapta Dhatu Nava Pancha Kosha Nava Pani Padam Na Chopastha Payu Chidananda Rupa Shivoham Shivoham Chidananda Rupa Shivoham